Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Couric.
And I'm Bozma St. John.
And this is Back to Biz
with Katie and Boz.
Boz, I'm really excited to have Brian Chesky on our podcast today. I've known him for a long time. He's been the boy wonder as the CEO of Airbnb.
Yes, for sure. I mean, even when I was in Silicon Valley at Apple and then at Uber, I was always impressed by what he was doing.
But his backstory is so interesting. For people who don't know, Brian started the company 12 years ago, yes, during a recession, with two buddies. He had studied industrial design at RISD. He moved to San Francisco, so he and his friends rented out their apartment when there was a convention in town, but not enough hotel rooms. They blew up a few air mattresses, and voila, the idea was born. Ergo, Airbnb. Get it?
Listen, I'm a marketer, and that joint is fresh. I like it.
Very fresh.
But the last couple of months have been crazy, right? He was about to go public, and then bam, here comes the pandemic.
I can't imagine, Boz, the stress he's been under in recent weeks. So we started there. We asked Brian just how he's managing right now.
Yeah, let's get to it.
Yeah, I think I'm doing about as well as somebody in my circumstance could be doing, right? It's been a pretty intense and harrowing 4 months or so. And I'm sure most people listening will have identified with that experience. You know, when we started Airbnb a dozen years ago, I had told myself, no, I don't think I'll ever do something as crazy as that. And I think we have experienced something that is probably even crazier than starting this company. When you're the child of two social workers and you're like unemployed and suddenly 12 years later, you have a company like Airbnb and you're going to go public, you have this real sense of, wow, I've really done something the last 12 years. So then to lose 80% of it in 5 weeks is like, that was definitely, if I thought my life was crazy the first 12 years, the next 5 weeks got even crazier, losing 80% of it or 70% of it. And then suddenly, you know, we found ourselves in this kind of total crisis where it felt like, you know, I don't know, probably like a lot of people, you feel like you're staring into the abyss and you can't quite tell if it will ever be better. And for me, so much of it was your psychology. It would have been so easy to just say, to spiral. And, you know, when you're responsible for thousands of people and, you know, everyone's pretty scared and a little freaked out, it's really, really important that the psychology organization matches and mirrors the psychology of the leader. And so you have to find a way to stay positive. And you have to find a way to say, for every single bad thing, this is an opportunity. I'm not going to exploit this, but every moment is a moment for us to do something that's defining to make us better. And that was the thing that we like went into this crisis with.
How did the pandemic fundamentally change your business? As you said, you were set to go public. Instead, you've taken a huge hit. You had to lay off 25% of your workforce in May. I know you've tried to be very generous to your employees. You let them keep their laptops, keep their health insurance for a year. But, how did you figure out how to move forward? And with all your hopes and dreams, as you said, shattered in a period of 5 weeks. Boom.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, and it felt so terrible because it wasn't just our hopes and dreams. It was all these employees who had stock. And, you know, and many people, I'm sure they were planning to do things like buy homes and stuff with that money. And they're really counting on it. And investors have been really patient with me. Probably the hardest thing, though, with the host, we have 4 million hosts, and 50% of them tell us that they depend on Airbnb to pay their rent or their mortgage. And we had guests who wanted to cancel their future Airbnb bookings because they told us, I can't travel. Well, it was more than $1 billion of cancellations. And the problem was that these were hosts who were depending on the money to pay their rent or mortgage entering an economic recession. So what do? When guests are telling you, I feel unsafe, I can't travel, I need a refund, and hosts saying, if you refund them their money, I'm going to be in a really bad economic position. And we ultimately did the following. We decided to refund the guests the money. We felt like we told the host, look, we have to do this because we're not siding with the guests, we're siding with health and safety. We can't have people being put in harm's way. And, you know, this is a global, at the time it was a global shutdown, 2.5 billion people shut down. So we can't be part of everyone traveling right now if they don't want to travel and they want their money back. But then, you know, there was a huge uproar and hosts were like super upset and they were very upset with us and me. And we decided to take, and this was at the depth of our kind of our own despair, $250 million of our own money. Now, in good times, it's, you know, you raise money. In bad times, though, it wasn't clear we'd be able to raise any money. So this was $250 million we thought we'd probably need. And we just gave it to our host. It didn't make them whole, but it was the most we could do. And then something crazier happened. Our employees pulled together their own money, $1 million of their own money, to give to host. And so then the founders, we put some of our money in and we started doing all these things. And that was probably the first kind of defining action we did. And then after that, we said to ourselves, you know, we're not as relevant right now as we used to be because people aren't traveling, but we can be useful in a crisis. And so we noticed that these nurses and firefighters and others and doctors were going to sites and they needed Airbnb, or they need homes to stay in, or they didn't want to stay with their families and get their families sick. So we worked with our host community, and 200,000 of our hosts offered homes for workers on the front line for a discount. And we kind of shared the discount. We had this product called Experiences, where you can do these 3-hour activities with locals.
I remember, Brian, when you and I talked about how you were expanding that service to Airbnb, you know, guests.
And it was the second act of Airbnb. And then it got stopped because, you know, social distancing, you can't be bringing travelers together from countries. It's like the exact opposite of what people want. So our host said, well, can we offer them online? And so in 14 days, our team built a product to create online experiences, which ended up being like the fastest growing product we ever created. So that worked out really well.
What, like master classes?
Yeah. They're kind of, but they're interactive. So basically it's a 1-hour activity. So I'll give you an example. We have Olympic athletes. So we did a partnership. We're one of the sponsors of the Olympics. The Olympics aren't happening this year. We got, I think, 30 Olympian athletes. And by the way, the average Olympic athlete, a lot of people don't know this, lives around the poverty line because a lot of them, you know, you dedicate your life to your sport. And then a lot of sports, you don't get a sponsorship. So they kind of have to start their careers over. And so we said, well, you know, we created a way for them to be able to offer a 1-hour kind of online class. You know, it could be a workout. It could be like learning about setting goals. It can be a bunch of things. We have about 30 of them now and hope to get a lot more. And then, of course, we had to raise $2 billion because we were burning cash very, very quickly. And then, of course, we had the layoff, which was probably the hardest decision I've ever made in my life. And it became an unavoidable truth when we realized, you know, travel stopped and we don't know what's going to return. And when it does return, we know it's going to be different. When you're in a crisis, you learn a lot about yourself in a crisis. You also get clarity in a crisis that you may not have had in any other period in your life. And in this crisis, I kind of got clarity. We got clarity. Like, why are we even doing this in the first place? Like, what would the world lose if we just disappeared tomorrow? And it became really clear that the part of Airbnb that was special were the everyday hosts that were offering like connection and belonging. And if we disappeared from this earth and they couldn't offer what they're offering, that would be the thing that would be bad. And she thought, you know, that's what we need to get back to. We need to get back to why we started this company, back to belonging, back to connection, back to empowering regular people, back to our roots. And so we decided we're going to scale back or shut down things that aren't that. So we paused our transportation effort. We had a content effort. We paused that. We scaled back our hotels business, you know, really just got really focused. And we said, that's what we're going to do. And, you know, I think we're going to build off that base now. So we're not as big as we were in some ways. We can't do everything we used to, but the things we're going to do, we're going to be very, very passionate about. And I think ultimately I'm hoping years from now, we'll look back on that as a really important decision.
When we come back, Brian Chesky on how travel will forever change.
You're listening to Back to Biz with Katie and Bose. Let's return to our conversation with Airbnb CEO, Brian Chesky.
By the way, I do have a confession for you.
Yeah.
That when I was at Uber, First of all, I'm a nerd of marketing, right? I obsess over everyone's creative, everyone's strategy, everyone's vision. And I was absolutely in love with the idea of belonging. Like I thought it was just, it just hit the mark so beautifully because in that instance, you don't have to pick a side, you know? It's not the folks who are booking versus the hosts, you know? It's not versus, it's just a belonging. Everybody wants to belong. And we all understand that from a very deeply emotional human level. And it is still true. You know, it's what we are dealing with right now with the crises in the world around racial inequality and everything else. Everybody wants to belong. It is the fundamental need, you know? And now I think there's also an opportunity to serve in sort of future hope about continuing to belong to the world, because what this pandemic has done has brought us home and we are, you know, inside and we are concerned and we're anxious. But we also want to connect back to people and back to outside. And, you know, we all have a deep longing for that. So what do you think is the future of travel and of that belonging to the world? Because let me tell you something, I'm tired of my house. Can I get some kind of membership, you know, for Airbnb where I could just, you know, frequently just move around the way I want to? Because I would like that future for myself.
That's actually a really good idea. We should talk about that.
I mean.
A really good idea. We should definitely talk about that. What is the future of travel? Well, I'm hoping and I think that travel will get more focused on communities, more focused on people, more intimate, authentic, small, off the beaten path, truly being connected to communities where you go, not being an outsider, being an insider. And I think that the last 50 years of travel has been very defined by being an outsider. The only other thing I'd say is I think that we used to live in this world where you lived in one place and you would take a week vacation somewhere else or you'd travel for business. And I think that is also changing. I think that living and traveling will blur together because now you could instead, like, you could go somewhere for a few months. Is that living or traveling, or is that something in between? And so I think you're going to see this blurring, the idea that people will be mobile. They won't just have mobile devices. They themselves will be mobile. I think that you're going to see travel being longer length of stay to smaller communities, to local, authentic, and more immersive, more experiential. Maybe the one thing that makes that obvious to me is if you ever want to know what the future will look like, just look at what young people want, because they're going to define that future. And the younger the person is, the more they want something that's authentic and the more they want to have an experience, not own a thing.
I remember reading that all these small towns across America were dying because the older residents were passing away. The younger people didn't want to stick around, and they were all migrating to cities because that was where the exciting cultural things were happening. So I'm curious what you see in the future for some of these major metropolitan areas. Do you think that there will be a return to more rural, kind of pastoral or bucolic, and all those words, lifestyles?
Yeah, and the short answer is yes, but I thought that the small communities, Pittsburgh's, I'll just pick Pittsburgh and Cleveland, I thought they were going to see a resurgence, but I thought that would happen over the course of 10 years. So I thought, you know, before COVID, that maybe by the year 2030 or 2040, that you would see the rise of small communities. And the reason why was, for the first time in human history, more people live in cities than out of cities. And the cities they're congregating to are not just metropolises, mega metropolises. So these are like 10 million plus cities like New York, or SF is only a million, but it feels really dense, the second densest city in the country, and then outside of the United States. And I think there was this problem where there was a little bit of an alienation of urban living. So people lived in apartment buildings, but they didn't quite know their neighbors. It was really expensive to live in cities. I mean, if you live in San Francisco, LA, New York, London, anyone living in these cities will know how expensive it is. And it was becoming like city life was becoming, I think, really, really hard. And for each new generation going to city, I think it was getting a little bit difficult. And so we're in a way, I think we were reaching what I call a temporary peak city moment. I thought that was going to take a lot longer. And I think what COVID did is I think it accelerated that. And I think the big other unlock was Zoom, because now people are realizing actually you can get work done without being in a space. Now, to be clear, I do think there's a huge value people being together. And I also want to be clear that I do not think this is the death of the city at all. I think it's like a sine wave. So I think you're going to see over the next 5 years, people doing what we're calling travel redistribution and population redistribution. I think you're going to see people traveling to smaller communities. And I think people are kind of, we've got used to this industrialized mass tourism world where you were in lines and crowds. And I think people really want something more intimate, more authentic. What I would say though is the following. I think New York's best days are ahead of it. I think Los Angeles' best days are ahead of it. I think big cities' best days are ahead of them, not behind them. But I think before they get better, they're going to get a little tougher. And I think what's going to happen is that you're going to see, this is a prediction. So it's, the risk of predictions is I'm wrong. But I do think you're going to see a population slowdown in urban cities. A lot of creative people, I come from a creative background, are going to choose. A lot of creative people were already not living in New York. They were going to New Jersey. They were going to all sorts of other places. It was just too expensive. They're going to redistribute. And then I think what's going to happen is cities are going to get cheaper. And as cities like New York get cheaper, then a new generation of people are going to go into cities, but they're going to come and they're going to bring a whole fresh perspective to new urban living. And I think they're going to do something awesome that, like, I'll be in the next 5 or 10 years, I can't predict. And I think the city will be something different.
When we come back, we ask Brian about Airbnb's race problem. That's right after this.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Back to Biz with Katie and Bose. Let's pick back up with Brian Chesky.
One of the things I'm hearing you say, Brian, is you think this pandemic is going to result in a real reset for society, for all of us, our priorities, our relationships, our hopes and dreams, how we want to live our lives. And I'm wondering, I hope so, because I think the world needed to be recalibrated. There was something that was off. But I wonder, after a vaccine comes about, do you worry and wonder, is it just going to go back to the way it was? Or do you think we will be forever changed?
I think it will be forever changed. I think the big question is, how long does this go on? And the longer the shutdown happens, the more we can't go back, and the more profound the shifts, because where people are going to invent and they're going to adapt and they're going to create new habits. And I think the way to ask this question is, how many things were we doing in the old way just because we were doing them or because they were habits? Because now we're going to have to make a choice to go back to the old way. We're not going to be doing that because we were just doing it all along. And so I think we will go back to a bunch of stuff because people will choose, but they're not going to choose everything. I think you're going to choose to only go back to the things that were essential. And then I think new things are going to emerge. So we'll go back a little bit. It's like a pendulum. I don't think we go back all the way. And my point of view on this would be, less will return than is intuitive, that this is a new world. And I think we're only the beginning of it, because we're 4 months into this. So yeah. I mean, it's probably going to go on. Like, we may not be in lockdown the rest of the year, but, like, I think another 4 months of this, I know our industry is going to be changed forever, and I doubt we're the only one.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed the conversation around change, because we've been waiting for it a long time, especially as it relates to diversity, inclusion, discrimination. Like, this is a time of real change. And, as a Black woman who travels alone by her, a lot for work and sometimes for personal, it's always been on my mind, how discrimination or my own safety, how I manage that in the world. And I wish that more companies and more businesses would pay attention, to my particular plight. I know Airbnb is certainly one in which, discrimination on the platform and within, the product has been a challenge. And so what are you thinking around that?
Yeah, I think this has been like a wake-up call for a lot of us and white people and like business leaders and others. Like it's just been a fundamental wake up call that I think that everyone needed. And so I think that's another example and a good example of we're not going back. Like whatever change happens to this front, it's happened and it's not going backwards. I think specifically to Airbnb, we have a unique history in this area. You know, in 2016, there was a hashtag that was trending on Twitter. And that hashtag was #Airbnb while black. And the hashtag basically meant that black travelers, primarily in the United States, were chronicling their experiences trying to book an Airbnb and being rejected by white hosts primarily. And it took me by surprise. And, you know, we're not fully conscious that our platform could be used for discrimination. So this became an existential risk to our business. And we ended up actually bringing Eric Holder before Uber. So we were the first ones to, I think, bring in Eric Holder. And he did a whole report and analysis. We worked with American Civil Liberties Union, this woman, Laura Murphy. And we basically created an anti-discrimination task force. And we made a bunch of progress. We did a couple things. Like one of the things we did, which seems really basic, was we asked everyone to basically like a test. It's kind of like checking a box, like a terms of service box, saying that you will not discriminate on the basis of like age, race, religion, orientation, gender, things like that. And 1.3 million people chose not to do that. So we said, fine, see you later. We were moving to the platform. And so, but we had limitations because we were not measuring the amount of discrimination on our platform. And as you know, in Silicon Valley, what you can't measure, you don't often optimize. And we were only responding to anecdotes. Now, it's really hard to measure discrimination. How do you do it? You have to know people's races to do that. Well, how do you find out someone's race without violating their privacy? And so what we ended up doing 2 years ago is we started engaging with Color of Change. They're obviously, you know, I think they're the largest online civil rights group. And we worked with them, other civil rights organizations, NAACP, and we worked with privacy groups because, you know, you got to be thinking about civil rights and privacy. And we designed a way where, and we just launched this like, I think it was a week ago, where we can collect this thing called perceived race data. Because of course, discrimination is about perceived race because no one asks somebody what their race is. They just perceive a race. But we had to do it in a way that was consistent with privacy. So it took us longer than I would want to admit. And we developed a bunch of principles. We said, you know, anyone who doesn't want to be in this research can opt out. We're going to decouple your perceived race from your account. And we're going to be transparent about what we're doing with this information and the results. And so now we have a way to like follow cohorts of data on our platform and then measure the bias and discrimination on our platform. And then hopefully with that data, we can then design our platform to be more equitable and create more belonging. I'm hoping there's a really big silver lining here. And we're going to open source our learnings around discrimination and also even how we work to anonymize this data. So this is just one of the things we're doing. And I don't say this to pat ourselves on the back because frankly, we got issues we got to work on. But I think we'll be remembered for what we do. And I think that every tech company, and probably every company, but every tech company, the world will remember what we did on this issue. We can either choose to be a mirror to society, or we can be a mirror to what we want society to look like. Those are literally choices we have. And why wouldn't we make that second choice? And why wouldn't we at least try? And so that's what we're doing.
I'm also very proud of Alexis Ohanian, is a friend because I'm friends with Serena Williams. But I am very impressed by his decision to, you know, step down from Reddit's board so that it could be filled by a black candidate.
And can I tell you about who that person is? Do you know him?
Yes, Michael, right?
You know his history with Airbnb?
No, please share.
Had it not been for Michael Seibel, I probably wouldn't be here telling you this story. Michael Seibel is Joe, Nate, and I started Airbnb. And I remember telling like people about Airbnb and they thought it was like the worst idea they'd ever heard of. And so we were trying to raise $150,000 at a $1.5 million valuation. Nobody won that deal. I mean, it just like we got introduced to 20 investors, couldn't get raised money. And we ended up meeting Michael Seibel. We met Michael Seibel in March 2008. Now, we launched in October 2007. And he basically, when I was like, we were nobody and we didn't know anybody, he took us under his wing because our roommate, my roommate, Joe and I, had was this guy named Phil. He worked for a company called Justin.tv. Michael Seibel was the CEO of Justin.tv, which is the basically the predecessor to Twitch with Amazon bought. And Michael basically met with us every Friday. And I'm not exaggerating, for like 3 to 5 hours. We'd go for happy hour. He'd take us to the site and we'd be there till like late in the evening. And he eventually helped us get into Y Combinator. And I think that he's probably, after the founders, the most significant person in the founding story of Airbnb. You know, and I think we used to call Michael the Godfounder, because like the Godfather, we go every week to him and we'd say, Michael, we got problems. Can you help us? But I just wanted to give a shout out to Michael because, you know, he embodies the culture of Silicon Valley. You know, he didn't want something from us. And he said, this is the culture. It's a culture of trust and you pay it forward.
Well, I think that's so, I mean, that's an amazing story, but it goes to the testament and probably points out even more so why there needs to be more open spots,
yeah,
you know, for people of color, Black people to be on boards who,
I agree,
you know, ordinarily wouldn't make it. So is there another Michael Seibel or Michaela Seibel somewhere who can step onto your board?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Brian, because, you know, there is a Quartz article, granted, from 2016 that says the dirty secret of Airbnb is that it's really, really white. So I'm curious about how you, if you've managed to change that and how you plan to continue changing it in the future.
Yeah, we're part of the way there, but not nearly where we need to be. Let's start with the board. So probably at the time that article was written, it would have been 5 people on the board, 3 founders were white guys. And then we had 2 venture capitalists. You know, when you raise money, a VC takes a board seat typically. And so since then we've appointed 4 independent board members. 3 were women, including my former COO. We have Ann Mather. She was the CFO of Pixar for Steve Jobs, audit chair of Google and Netflix. And then Angela Renz, you probably know, she ran Apple retail and before that was CEO of Burberry. And then we added Ken Chenault, who was CEO of Amex. So not to make excuses, but we are trying, but we definitely need to get more diverse even on the board. And so absolutely, I'm definitely be interested in us continuing to add a couple more people, you know, in time. I don't know when, but absolutely. On the executive team, you know, we also need to make progress. We have set diversity targets that we want by the end of next year, 20% of our board and executive team to be people of color. I think we can get there for sure. And maybe we can beat that actually. And you know, I think that we've like the last 3 hires I made, 2 of them are women. My head of operations, Tara Bunch, she was running operations for Apple. And I hired this woman named Catherine Powell, who ran basically 70% of the Disney parks. And I mean, I will just say from my experience, and I can say this, a more diverse company is not only the responsible thing to do, it is actually a competitive advantage.
Right.
You know, I really mean that. Like we became so much higher performing when we started becoming more diverse. And we're not there. We're not even close to where we need to be. We should at least map to the demographics in the country you operate. So if, you know, like you shouldn't, and you could be better, but you shouldn't be worse than that. So we want to go a lot further.
I was going to say, given this reckoning that and the movement we're witnessing and this realization and wake-up call, as you referred to it, Brian, of systemic racism and what is just no longer acceptable. I mean, you can't really get away with not being diverse. I mean,
no.
Not only for all the reasons you just outlined, but let's face it, it's just not it's not an acceptable look anymore.
No, it's and that is as it should be. It's probably overdue, and so that will be one of the good that come out of a crisis, right?
Are you embarrassed you haven't done more, Brian?
I wish I did more. I wish I did more sooner. And I'm proud of what we have done. I think, you know, a company like ours, mission is built around belonging, connection. I think that's like really, really important. And so, if I could have done it over again, I would have done more sooner. And I think that's a good lesson here for everyone, that every one of us could be doing more sooner.
Bose, I think Brian is absolutely right. I think there wasn't an urgency to fix this problem before, but there's certainly an urgency now. And hopefully this will be a real moment in time where things will change for the better, finally.
I really hope so. I mean, we're demanding more of ourselves right now, and that's really what matters.
Again, we've been talking to Brian Chesky, the CEO of Airbnb. And that does it for this week's episode of Back to Biz with Katie and Bose. If you're not already, you can subscribe to the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
And you can learn more about all the cool people we're talking to, as well as our favorite moments from these interviews, on our Instagram feeds and stories.
Until next time, I'm Katie Couric.
And I'm Bozema St. John, and this is Back to Biz
with Katie and Bose. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Back to Biz with Katie and Bose is a production of iHeartRadio and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are Katie Couric, Bozema St. John, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. The associate producers are Derek Clements, Eliza Costas, and Emily Pinto. Editing by Derek Clements and Lauren Hansen. Mixing by Derek Clements. Special thanks to Adriana Fazio. For more information about today's episode, go to katiecouric.com. You can also follow Katie Couric and Bozema St. John on Twitter and Instagram. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.